ask you, do you ever sit and wonder it's so strange we could be together for so long and never know, never care what goes on in the other one's head. Things I felt but I never said. You said things that I never said, so I'll say something that I should have said long ago.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 46. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from June 11th, 2014. The one-shot, That's Because You're a Robot, and Original Sins number 1. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we talked with writer J.M. DeMatteis. And just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Hey, this is Christopher Sabella calling. Question was about... creators, your favorite experience meeting a comics creator, IRL. Mine was 2 years ago at Emerald City Comic Con, at the Sheridan, where everybody drinks, and I was pretty lit up, and I went outside to smoke, and saw Chris Robertson was standing there with a couple other dudes. So I went up to join them, and Chris Robertson introduced everybody, and then the last person, he's like, this is Garth Ennis. And I was like, could not hold in my complete delight at that, and just like uttered, oh, holy shit. Therefore, totally wrecking any cool points I might have had saved them. But he was totally nice about it, and I smoked a cigarette with Garth Ennis, so that's pretty good. Okay, I love you all. Bye.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is You Ain't Who You Say You Are. You know that terrible feeling when you discover way late in the game that someone you really thought you knew is in fact totally different in every way? It never works in the positive direction either. It's not like suddenly they turn awesome after being a giant asshole. No, it's totally like after years and years of trusting you really know someone, boom, you wake up and realize it was all a lie, and I'm not projecting at all. Anyway, comics. We are looking at two comics that touch on that big reveal, that big realization that there's a whole lot more or less going on under the surface than you expected. Could be robots, could be secrets, murder, mayhem, mystery. Could be that the comic itself is completely not what you expected. Really, it's fine.
It could be you start a podcast with someone and, you know, they're not at all who they said they were.
I know, I'm so much more delightful than you thought that I was.
Hey, how's it going? It's Adrian from the podcast, Adrian and Atlas Have Issues. Oh man, there's so many awesome people I've met at comic book conventions, but one of my favorite creators I've met had to be Peter David. Huge fan of his work from both, you know, books and comics, especially his X-Factor series. And, you know, a really down-to-earth, awesome guy. Like, he's one of those people that you can literally just talk to about anything, even without comic books. I'd say it's between him and Becky Cloonan, she's just fantastic in general. I honestly, I can go on forever, because for the most part, almost everybody I've met at conventions is just really great, and it's awesome to meet people who love their work. And speak a living to work, Comics Therapy, awesome podcast, and also feel free to check out my show, adrianatlaspodcast.com, or check us out on Twitter, at adrianatlaspod. An awesome show, and enjoy.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating what we love, for the most part, about comics. This week, we asked you to share your best stories about meeting your favorite creators in person. You can always call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
Hey guys, James Kaplan here, SinisterJHK on Twitter. And my favorite experience meeting a comics creator in real life happened about a month ago. I was in London for work, and I went by Orbital Comics, great shop. And they happened to be having a signing that week. So I went by, and the signing was led by David Lloyd, legendary comics creator and artist on V for Vendetta, who was doing a signing there along with other creators as part of his weekly online comics magazine. So I got to meet him and David Hine and other creators. I got a sketch from David Lloyd, who was super nice and super gracious. And then at the end of the event, Chris from Orbital Comics invited me to come along with them to the pub. So I certainly wasn't going to say no to that. So I got to go along with them to the pub, chat with the artists a little bit, and then David Lloyd ended up even buying me a drink. So I have to say that was my favorite experience meeting a comics creator in real life. Thanks.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. It's my birthday week, Aaron. Tell me something good.
It's not your birthday day, and you're not 12.
It's a big birthday. Come on.
I guess.
It is. We always assign more importance to multiples of five. I think that in society, that is a recognizable misrepresentation of the importance of aging.
Sure, that's fine. I will not begrudge you your exuberance over your birthday. 29 is a big number. I don't know what that is, why that's a multiple of five, but congratulations.
Because yeah, I'm not. Yep. Okay. It's cool. Birthday week. Tell me something good.
I got a lot of comics this week.
Something different.
I got a lot of good comics this
week. Oh, well, that is notable.
No, not really. What's the most exciting thing? I'll tell you what's notable about comics.
What?
Every one of my comics came into my LCS. My entire Diamond order actually shipped. I don't know if that's ever happened.
Oh, seriously? I thought the issues that you've been having were more recent.
No, it's either a mix of something wasn't put in my box or something just got delayed. There's always something every week. It's fine because I have two stores that I go to on Wednesday.
Right.
So usually if there's not something at my main store, then when I go to the second store, I can find it there.
Got it.
But I only had to do, for new comics, just one store. That's a big deal.
And some of those things that arrived were for me for my birthday, right?
Sure. We're still doing presents at 29?
June 17th.
You don't like print comics. You just gave me a steamer trunk full.
You don't have to only buy comics at your comic shop.
Well, you don't buy t-shirts anymore there.
I don't buy t-shirts at all.
Oh, so. You're too good for t-shirts. Okay.
No, that's not what I meant.
Cool.
I mean, shut up. Fine. It'll have to be something better. Better than comics. Can you think of something better for my birthday than comics?
I can't think of anything better than comics for any day. But it makes sense.
Right. What's your answer for your most positive, exciting meeting of a creator?
This is really hard for me to answer because I haven't really had... I've had what I would consider neutral, on the low end, but most of my experiences are usually really good to amazing.
Okay.
I guess the one that stands out was fairly recent at this last Wizards World in Portland, where... George Perez was there, and it was great. Personally, it was great meeting him, but I think what really stood out for me is that, thousands of people he's seen over these 2 days, every person he talked to and came up to him, he had the same exuberance and excitement to take pictures of them, take pictures with them, sign whatever they wanted, it didn't waver, and it wasn't disingenuous either. So, that was for somebody who's been in the industry for so long and has met so many people to have such a positive attitude like that is, doesn't make sense to me. I couldn't do it. And
you're not the social butterfly that, you appear to be on this podcast.
Oh yeah. That's true. Sorry. Sorry to break it to everyone.
Who's on your creator bucket list?
It's hard to say. It depends for what, just to meet, I don't know. I get, the more people I meet and the more good experiences I have, the more nervous I get that there's going to be that one where it's somebody I really respect and it's going to be a crappy interaction.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of people that I would say who have been working in the industry a long time and might not be doing conventions, for that much longer, that are people I would like to meet sooner rather than later.
Because they're old? What? I don't know what you're implying.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
You know, not to be morbid, but it's like some people you want to meet and have that experience, you know, for yourself before they don't want or are unable to attend anymore.
That's not morbid, dear. That's selfish.
Well, yeah, conventions are selfish.
Okay.
You're going to meet people for yourself.
No, you're totally right.
It is. Yeah. But it's, that's fine, because that's what they're set up for.
Because that's what they're for.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, like I really am sad that Joe Kubert died before he was supposed to come to Stumptown 2 years ago. Like, he died, you know, a couple months before the show.
Okay.
And that would have been, you know, really something. So, yeah, stuff like that. So, what about you?
I don't know. I hate having to think of a really great, snappy answer to these.
It's almost like if we had time, like, but you know, just the mics turn on, we have to record, you know, like we don't set that time or anything.
You'd think that having posted this 6 days ago, I would have given it some more legitimate thought, but.
Right, no, I mean, it's not fair. The hosts of the show just don't give us any time to think about an answer for this.
Yeah, bunch of fascists.
Mm-hmm.
I love Emerald City, as it is well documented, because the conversations that I've had with creators there have been super fun. It's obviously growing very large, but still feels manageable. And there's still like an intimacy with a lot of the spaces. Like the crowd control and the movement of people in the 2 years that I've been there has allowed for creators that I wanted to talk to like actually have that space and that time to do so. So that it was not just a transaction necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's, you're right, it's inherently selfish. But when you have applied a like personal connection to somebody's work, I think that when you have the chance to meet them, you're hoping for a personal interaction and not just a transaction. And so my goal when I have the chance to meet a creator is to have that little moment that is like more of a memory and less of just a sale.
Fine. But you're not going to name names. There's nobody that stands out.
No. Sure. In cases where I've gotten to be friends with them, that is super fun to actually then meet them in person. And yeah, I mean, I was going to tell the story of driving Adam to Seattle, but I think I also already told that story. There's nothing specific about.
I know there's a lot of fan fiction online about it.
Right. Don't make it weird. I think the moral of the story is that Adam is a native New Yorker and like just doesn't understand cars and is not a great navigator.
As I understand them, they're like horseless carriages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great driving companion in terms of the storytelling potential. Not so awesome as a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine.
Well, if, you know, it really shows that there's a need for somebody to invent some sort of device.
Gosh,
that could,
if only there was.
Right.
Yeah. Some kind of way to, like, harness the, I don't know, like some kind of system of presenting roads in an orderly fashion so that then you could predict the one that you wanted to drive on to get to your destination.
Then all these interpersonal conflicts would just kind of go away. It just wouldn't be a problem.
Why are we talking about comics and not revolutionizing transportation right now with horseless carriages and fucking GPS systems?
Because we stick to what we're good at.
Right. Are we good at this?
We are good at talking for about 40 minutes.
Yes.
And
yes,
recording that and then putting it onto the internet. The quality of the contents therein, probably not.
Yes. Your mileage may vary.
We can fill time.
We can. We can. Jazz hands.
So let's fill some time.
You want to talk about comics?
Sure. That works.
Blow my mind with this first one. Go ahead.
Oh, boy.
This is Captain Cummings, and this week's question is, what best experience meeting a comics creator? Well, I think that the nicest person that I've on and getting books signed and that sort of thing would be Scott Snyder. And the reason for this is he always seems really nice and sincere, like he wants to be there. Not like most people want to be there, they seem anyway. But I remember I had a book that came out, that one of the Batman books that came out that week, and it seems like his books are always metaphorically written, like there's hidden things that mean different things to the story. And I didn't catch one of the things and understand it, so I asked him why, and he gave me a long, long answer that seems like what it really would have been instead of, like, what some people would have done, where they kind of give you, like, a shortened explanation where you still wouldn't understand. But after he was done explaining everything, I knew exactly what was going on in the story, and I appreciated it more. And I don't think I could explain it back, especially now that it's been like months, but it was cool at that time. I was like, huh, oh yeah. All right, so that's it. See you guys later.
Our first book is That's Because You're a Robot, a one-shot written by David Quantick with art by Shaky Kane. Lettering is by Jimmy Bellencourt. That's Because You're a Robot is published by Image Comics.
That's a T, Jimmy Bettencourt.
Okay. Look, you give me the names every week, and you know I cannot read names.
I know. Names it still is amusing to me, although it's wildly disrespectful.
I don't get it, Andia.
You don't get a what?
I don't get it, Andia. Why do you always do this to me?
Oh. That wasn't funny enough to be a thing.
Yeah, you don't have a sense of humor. That's the problem.
You're right. And as we're about to find out, we're going to get into particular book. You could say Andrea if you really wanted to irk me.
Or no.
Andrea, or fucking anything that isn't my actual name.
Okay.
Let's talk about comics, Myers.
You're so full of yourself this week.
It's my birthday week!
All right, let's talk about comics. So tell me what this is about.
This is about two cops who are informed that one is a robot. Da-da-da!
Mm-hmm.
And then hijinks ensue. Da da da.
All right. That's fine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you did not like this because you don't like fun. Is it true? Like, can you think of, like, absurdist comics that you really like?
Oh, man. Way to put me on the spot.
Because this is an absurdist comic.
I didn't dislike it, first of all.
No, but I don't think you liked it as much as I did.
But... You know, we're allowed to have divergent tastes. That's why we're...
Sure, but, I mean, in this case, you're just wrong. So it's not a matter of taste.
Am I ever right?
Sometimes, sure, yeah.
Okay.
I think there were a couple times, like, where I didn't get things, and then you blew my mind. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I do recall that one time.
Yeah.
In this case, you're just incorrect.
Huh. I think it's a matter of taste. It's a matter of comedy taste.
Maybe it's the you know, the one of them's a robot kind of like continuing joke throughout. That's just a comedy.
That was hilarious.
Okay.
Okay. There's no, don't worry about it. That's the kind of stuff that I think is like super funny. Beating a dead horse in a joke. I'm the queen of that.
Okay. So as long as it's using the jokes that you would tell, you're fine.
No, it's not quite like that. I think that, by and large, what I want from that kind of, like, humor that uses that one joke repeatedly or that hand of five or six jokes repeatedly,
mm-hmm.
is that it's combined with something else that operates on a more sophisticated level.
Yeah, but it's a one-off
issue. I know. It was fine. Okay. You're doing to me the exact same thing that I feel like happened when we talked about Dave, which is really making it about my personal tastes, and that's not what we're supposed to be talking about.
I just find I'm trying to help you understand why your sense of humor is so incorrect.
Awesome, because that's what I really need in my life is yet another person telling me that I suck because I don't like what they like.
Let me explain to you why you're wrong.
Okay.
Oh, really? That was just a joke, too. See, this is the problem. Mm-hmm. You can't pick up on context clues. you don't understand sophisticated humor.
It's not sophisticated humor.
I'm guessing you wanted this to be like an episode of Jackass just on the paper, right? That's what you were expecting?
No.
No.
Wait, is that... Have I somehow given you the impression that that's my sense of humor?
Well, you don't like sophisticated humor.
No, I do. That was my point, is that I like sophisticated. I like things that are clever. And when they're combined with something that is more like repetitive one-liners, then that's my jam.
Okay, so then what doesn't click with you on this then? And this isn't about reviewing it. This is about, I'm trying to understand the...
This is about me. You're making it into being about me, and I'm actually resisting that.
Which you usually like to talk about you.
I do.
And I'm doing especially, this for free, too.
You know why? This week, of all the weeks.
Did you skip?
I don't know if I mentioned.
Oh, right. It's your birthday week. Yes, we got it.
Yeah, got it.
All right,
I can do this next week, too, right? Because it'll be like my actual birthday week.
Of course, yeah. Let's keep on trucking.
Okay. I think that, quite honestly, there were things about this that made me wish that it wasn't a one-shot.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think that's what the idea is for this anyway. Like, I don't think it ends here. If there's probably plans for more. Well, it's just like I equate this, even though they have similar, I guess, based storylines in a way. Like, you know, the one-shot buddy cops,
mm-hmm.
the Dark Horse. Like, mm-hmm. there could be more of that. They were just mm-hmm. there. It was, you know, a one-off issue. But you could definitely write more from that. You can expand it out.
Mm-hmm.
It just sets the stage, and it's more about exploration of like character types and just humor for humor's sake, and just going to absurd places both artistically and, you know, writing.
Yeah, I think that is what I have had more difficulty with. And maybe you're right. I think like absurd for the sake of absurd is something that I've gotten away from appreciating more recently, and I've been reading and watching and enjoying things with much more complex stories. So to shift gears and just look at something that is light and absurdly funny is like, it makes it into way much more work than it should be for something that is like really approachable and amusing. Like, that's because you're a robot.
I almost equate this to like, you take Dumb and Dumber and you tell them one of you is a robot, and you see how they parse that out continuously.
Right, right. It's, I mean, it was actually smarter than that.
But it, you know, it's sort of like similar. It's like that, well, that's a funny kind of conceit.
Sure, sure. And the level of acceptance with the world building, like, I'm all about that. Obviously, we're talking about like a cyborgy kind of cop. So all the rest of the crazy shit that happens as they're dealing with whatever it is that they're dealing with, I can buy into that. It wasn't that the whole thing didn't click or fell flat. It's me. It's not them. It's me.
Okay, that's fine. I can accept that. As long as you're the problem, we can move on.
I am always the problem. But I think the... That's because you're a robot as the ultimate like trump card for every single joke is hilarious. I want to make that clear, that will always be something that I find amusing.
Or do you? Or do you only find it amusing because you're a robot?
Shut up. If anybody thinks that of the two of us, you're not the robot, then they have never actually listened to the show.
That's just what a robot would say.
Well done.
Would you like to move on to the next book, Andrea?
Sure.
Have you ever seen War Games?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, did you hear that a computer passed the Turing test?
I did, but did you actually read what sort of parameters that they had to put into the program to get it to pass the Turing test? And like, do you know that to pass the Turing test, it's only 30%?
Yeah, that's fine. Most people can't even do that. I'd say my average for most people just in life is probably 25%. So far,
your average what?
Just a judgment level. So, I mean, if a computer's getting 30, I'd probably rather talk to
computers.
In this
case, I think it
was
33%.
Yeah, that's even better. That's like the best conversation I've ever had.
But it was 33% with a non-native English-speaking, like, 14-year-old boy.
That's my wheelhouse.
Okay. I'm just going to put that one right there and let you run with it.
Hi, guys. Jason Sachs here, at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. I am the publisher of Comics Bulletin, at Comics Bulletin on the Twitter. One of the greatest experiences that I ever had meeting a comics creator was an interview I got to do with Jerry Robinson, who, and they're famous, including, you know, on important things like Robin and the Joker. Yes, that's the man who invented the Joker. And my buddy Alex Roderick and I interviewed Robinson about 5 years ago for my site. At that point, Robinson was in his late 80s. Alex was in his 20s. And we called up Mr. Robinson and started asking him just a few very simple questions. And the man was brilliant. He went on for easily an hour and 15 minutes telling really detailed, interesting stories about the creation of Batman, especially about the creation of the Joker, all his deep influences on the Joker, where the Joker came from. The man had story after story after story. It was clear from the way he told his stories that he was just completely happy with the way his life turned out. He had a number of really remarkable experiences, including traveling abroad during the heart of the Cold War to Soviet-based countries, the Warsaw Pact countries, and also being right there at the beginning of Batman and Robin. It was what made the interview so surreal and kind of magical was that Mr. Robinson could go on forever. Literally, Alex and I were on the edge of our seats listening to him tell his stories, and after an hour and 30 minutes, we were basically beat, but Mr. Robinson could have kept going. It was just such a remarkable reminder that no matter how old you are, you're as young as you feel like you are in your heart. If you're interested in reading that interview, it's posted to my website. Just Google Jerry Robinson, Comics Bulletin. It's a great piece and well worth listening to. Thanks, Andrea and Aaron, for reminding me of this wonderful memory, which caused you to forget your names. What a doofus, but what a great memory. Thanks. Bye.
Our second book this week is Original Sins Number 1, which contains three stories. The first is written by Nathan Edmondson, with art by Mike Perkins, and colors by Andy Troy. The second is written by Ryan North, with art by Ramon Villalobos, and colors by Jordan Gibson. And the third is written by Stuart Moore, with art by Rick Geary, and colors by Ive Svorchina? Close. Clayton Coles lettered the whole book. Original Sins is published by Marvel Comics and supplements the Original Sin event, as you may have guessed.
Okay.
I mean, I got that. That was better than 33%.
Sure, but that was just speaking names. That wasn't interacting. A computer could do better than 33% of that.
Well, yeah, computers are a lot better than I am. I've never claimed to be better than a computer.
That's because you're a robot.
Let's talk about this.
Can that be a thing with us now? Because, damn, why didn't I think of that sooner?
I mean, for like another 20 minutes. See, okay. Nat, see how great that book is?
That book has given me a lot of one-liners. And that's often what I need. It's just not what I am looking for. So I guess it's a win-win.
Sometimes you get the one-liner you need, not the one-liner you deserve.
Tell me about Original Sins.
To talk about Original Sins doesn't really matter other than it's a tie into the Original Sin event, which I find
you
interesting.
You picked it. Is that what you wanted to actually talk about?
Well, as a supplement to the larger event, sure.
Because I think that this book is relevant this week because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, that's fine.
There, I said it.
Fine. That is a meta explanation of why it works.
I wanted to... And maybe that's where this is going to go, but I want to find out the specific sins that were, like, released out into the world.
Well, it's more that because the Watcher's eye has been, you know, removed from his body and part of its force, it reveals, you know, everyone's deep, dark secrets.
Like, yeah, are you just, like, mansplaining what I just said? Because, yes.
Yes.
That's what I want to find out.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about Marvel Comics and superheroes.
Okay. Yep.
Andrea, if you could just sit back, look, let me tell you a little bit about superhero comic books.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, I know you. We probably won't get this, but...
Because you're a robot.
No, this
did
is,
I do that
know,
right?
No, no. Listen, sweetheart, just sit back, okay? Just listen. I'm going to tell you something here. This is really important, especially when you're talking to men, so you don't look stupid in front of them.
You do that too well.
Maybe I should do some sort of, I don't know, like whatever it is, the game, you know, like seminars. but for comic book nerds, like how to pick up chicks at comic book stores.
Oh, God.
You know, that's... when you're like, fellas, when you're standing in front of the rack and some hottie comes up to it, you gotta, you know, when you pull, you gotta pull out like a Superman, because they'll kind of understand that usually. Or, you know, you can do Wonder Woman if you think you could be smooth enough. They usually don't understand the other stuff. So you gotta keep it really kind of high level. Okay, guys. All right. Now, here's really important. Don't look at their boobs all the time. Okay.
See, I think that is comedy right there. Not everybody, especially right now with what kind of actual bullshit is happening in the industry and outside of the comic book world, is going to appreciate that. Just saying.
Well, I've been a lightning rod for a lot of things lately. So if people don't understand that that's humor, I'm sorry. But I'm not sorry.
No, you're not sorry.
No. Anyway, I don't even know what I was explaining to you.
You were trying to explain to me how this fits in with the larger event. And I know how it fits in with the larger event. What I am explaining to you is that I was hoping that we would get mini stories of various characters and a peek into the secrets that were revealed about them.
Well, this is like one of six, right?
Yeah, but we really didn't get that yet. We got an advertisement for a Deathlok comic, which is clearly tying into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Okay, fine. We could have all predicted that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a really strange interpretation of Young Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, on the one hand, fantastic, because I would love to read more of those characters. And parts of it, I thought, were handled, you know, very appropriately. But on the other hand, I don't know yet how much of a necessary story it is within the larger event. And there were things that were mentioned in Original Sin, what was that, 2 or 3, that like actually indicated some of the immediate repercussions of that event, the event, if you will, that I am much more interested in exploring.
That's fine.
Like, if half of the team has disappeared because they can't fucking function because of the things that were revealed when the Watcher's Eye exploded, I want to know what those were, and I want to deal more with that.
Well, you don't always get that in the first issue.
I know. So, I'm super whiny. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's like, that's why it's an event. It's not a one-shot.
That's
wait,
right.
So you don't like events. You don't like one-shots.
I don't like humor.
You don't like humor.
I love birthdays, though.
Yeah. You love your birthday.
I love other people's birthdays.
Do you?
Yeah. Yes. I make a really big deal out of birthdays.
Weird.
Why? It is literally the only day where you can celebrate a single person. You don't have to share it with other mothers or other fathers. You don't have to make it be about anything spiritual if you're not comfortable with that. It is a way of saying, you know what? I think you're fucking great. And I am going to celebrate the day that you came into the world because I'm glad you're in my world.
But maybe you should just do that every day.
Oh, that was almost sweet.
Almost.
Hmm.
Thank you, Andrea.
How do you feel about this event as a whole?
So far, fine. I like the premise. I like, you know, I like that idea, especially if you're talking about a Marvel universe with like a lot of continuity. There's a ton of horrible stuff that every character has done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I kind of like that whole like, well, here's all the cards on the table. I think even if that happened in regular life, you know, society would melt down.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
there's a reason why we tell white lies.
Mm-hmm.
It protects the teller and the tellee.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a very strong aversion to lying. I mean, I know that sounds really stupid because nobody probably enjoys being lied to, but I have found myself in situations and then as a result feel like I have a greater sensitivity to that and like trust issues, blah, blah, blah. But even so, I think that I agree that there's like an underpinning to the way that the world works that kind of relies on need to know. And if you strip that away, then there are all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Hell, our government runs on that.
Right. Everybody's government runs on that.
Yeah, it's true. So, you know, it's a human thing. Like, we are not meant to know everything about each other.
Right.
So. Right.
That's because you're a robot.
Well, I know everything about everyone.
Because you're a robot?
Just, you know, plugged into the Matrix.
Hmm.
Yeah, I also think in the computing age, we have our secrets through kind of obscurity that most people, we just don't matter. So it doesn't matter. But if anyone wants to turn the, you know, the eye of the watcher upon us, or, mm-hmm. you know, the eye of Sauron or whatever you want to call it, there's no hiding these days.
Right.
You know, so it's almost like because we are just, you know, our worker bees or, you know, computers humming along in a closet recording a podcast, whatever you want to call it. It's, you know, nobody really cares about us unless you give a reason to.
Mm-hmm.
So keep that in mind, people. That's a warning to you.
What are you suggesting?
Just keep your heads low. Do your jobs.
Keep your heads down.
Yeah. No one gets hurt.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. I think though that there's an acceptance of that norm. Like, we embrace the hiding.
Yeah.
We use it to our advantage.
Sure. I actually see like younger people, you know, now that you're old, there's a younger generation that doesn't care about being anonymous or having privacy. Like, the more public they are, the better.
Is it, like, you see that with your daughter, or you see that with kids younger than that?
No, about her age.
Okay.
I mean, even myself, I've kind of accepted that. That just being public, you know, is just part of it. It's part of the social contract now.
You don't believe in constructing an online persona and keeping other things private?
You can, but if anyone wants to look into something, it's not hard to find out about people, you know?
Yeah, I guess I'm speaking less tangibly.
Well, but it's the same as if you're having, you know, interpersonal, just a regular face-to-face interactions
true.
With people.
Very
I
true.
Think it's easier to sculpt your online persona to, like, what you want it to be, but...
Mm-hmm.
You know, over time, I think that, you know, the truth of it comes out. It's just if you decide to be public and participate in the current version of, you know, a public society, you give up anonymity to do that, to be able to participate.
It's because you're a robot.
Well, I got nothing to hide. It's got a room full of comics, a wife and two kids, and a dog.
Creepy robot sex.
Well, just on one side, I'm pretty sure my wife's a human.
How would you know, though?
I don't really care. I mean, she gave birth. Can robots
very
do that?
Very sophisticated
robots. Like is this like a Cylon situation?
You know, I never watched that.
No, oh my God. This is our last podcast.
Really? That's going to be it?
Like, well, you haven't seen Battlestar Galactica. You refuse to show your child Iron Giant.
I don't refuse to show him. I just haven't yet.
It's been
in
like
fact, I promised your wife that I was going to show it to him by the end of this week.
Yeah, I've been telling you for like 3 years. And I think
I
3 years ago you said, oh yeah, we'll do
Chrissy,
that.
Chrissy, your wife, who is human, unlike you, that I would show it to him by the end of this weekend or else she was going to sever all ties.
That's fair.
Yeah, you just give me an ultimatum.
I want to see. So, yeah.
I don't respond well to threats. I don't respond well to chastisement or disdainment or, you know, making me feel stupid because I haven't seen something. But if you offer to watch it with me, or if you, I don't know, appeal to my, like, interests and explain to me why it's going to add something positive to my life, then, you know, I'll add it to the top of the list.
Listen, sweetheart, let me explain to you why you should watch Battlestar Galactica.
I think mansplaining Aaron Myers is way my favorite now. Do it.
I'm all tapped. No, now I don't want to do it when people want me to do it. I only respond to negative reinforcement.
Oh, but wait, that's like the entire basis of our relationship.
Yeah, that's true. That's why we keep doing these shows, I guess. Well, I'm talking about positive reinforcement.
Yes.
Do you want to talk to this week's guest?
We did, as a matter of fact. No, already talked to this week's guest.
This is about the illusion of continuity.
There is no illusion of continuity. Not even in the Marvel universe is there an illusion of continuity.
But the Andrea Aaron universe, we strip that all away.
Honey, there's no Andrea Aaron universe.
It's time is a flat circle here, kind of thing.
We are very rarely in the same place for our own personal safety.
Yeah, obviously.
Right.
But that's still the same universe, still the same continuity.
Oh, wait, can you explain to me how that works?
Listen, sweetheart, let me tell you a little bit about our universe. I'm going to try to break this down for you in a way you can understand. Are you sitting down? Do you have some water?
Oh, man.
Do you feel okay?
This is wildly entertaining for me and probably not for anybody else, but that's okay because, you know, it's my birthday.
Yep. Well, let's just move on to a wonderful interview.
Fantastic. We talked to J.M. DeMatteis and had a blast. What a phenomenal set of insight and perspective with his decades in the industry, and it was excellent. Have a blast yourselves.
Enjoy.
Hey guys, I want to drop you a line about my favorite creative meeting. Last year at a convention here in Melbourne, Australia, I had the absolute pleasure of meeting Dan Slott. We talked Spider-Man 2099 and further the period Spidey storyline. I went back with a friend later in the day as he wanted to talk to him about his She-Hulk and Thing run. Sitting in a stinking hot convention hall with hardly anyone around, Dan proceeded to talk to us about what he had planned for Ben Grimm up to issue 30, which would have had Ben proposed to Alicia by singing a song from the street up to her window. And then it happened. Dan thanked us in Ben Grimm's voice. It was the most surreal and wonderful moment. Something I'll never forget. Also, if there's ever another Fantastic Four cartoon, Dan needs to voice the thing. That's just my personal opinion. But that was my experience. Thanks for the podcast. It's a wonderful show. This is Andrew Shaw.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Eisner Award-winning writer J.M. DeMatteis. Over his 35-year career, J.M. has written lengthy runs on Captain America and Spider-Man for Marvel, including the critically acclaimed Kraven's Last Hunt storyline. He's written countless Justice League stories for DC over the years, winning the Eisner in 2004 for the miniseries formerly known as The Justice League, with Keith Giffen and Kevin Maguire. His graphic novels Mercy and Moonshadow, among others, helped launch the DC imprint Vertigo in the 90s. He's written all-ages comics and prose like, I should have asked you about pronouncing this one. I put the emphasis on the first one. Tell me how to say it. Abadazad?
That's good. That's exactly right.
Oh, fantastic. Like Abadazad and the novel Imaginalis, as well as episodes of Teen Titans Go, Ben 10, and other animated shows. He's currently writing Justice League 3000 for DC Comics. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
So we always like to start the show with an overview before we get deeper into our questions. In your case, can we do it kind of two ways? Are there any other career highlights you want to mention beyond the quick list that Andrea just ran through? I mean, there's a lot, and we didn't want to spend...
There's really a lot, and you know, I don't even, Moonshadow, Brooklyn Dreams. I think if I had to pick three projects out of all these years, I'd probably pick Moonshadow, Brooklyn Dreams, and Abadazad as my three absolute tip-top favorite things that I've ever done. But there's so much other stuff that I love, not to mention all the other stuff that I'm completely embarrassed by and want to sweep under the rug. But, it's a lot of material. Like, I wouldn't expect anyone in a brief introduction to hit, 30-plus years worth of material.
My personal ad would be Will World, even though it's a mouthful. That's one of my favorites.
Will World, if only for the art alone. I mean, it was a fun story. I'm not trying to, false humility here. But the art was so sensational that even if the story had sucked, it would still be a great book,
And that there's a tinge of tragedy to that, too, because the art is so beautiful and Seth Fisher gone too soon.
Yeah, that was just, I sometimes, you know, a lot of people ask about that project, and I just wonder, what would he be doing now if he was that talented then and doing such amazing work? I can't imagine what he'd be up to by now.
Yeah, I agree. I did not mean to bring the conversation down already. So let's look to the future, too. What about the rest of 2014? Is there anything you want people to be aware of that we should look out for that you can announce?
Well, let's see. What am I working on right now? At DC, I'm doing Phantom Stranger. I'm doing Justice League Dark, Justice League 3000. And we just wrapped up War Flees. The last issue, I think, comes out in August.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two creator-owned projects, but they won't be out till next year. One of them is a sequel to something I did for IDW last year called The Adventures of Augusta Wind. It's an all-ages project, and people appreciated the Batazad and the Stardust Kid and Imaginalis. Then Augusta Wind is something I think they'll appreciate. The first five issues was collected in a beautiful hardcover edition by IDW, and we're going to do a five-issue sequel that will wrap up the story next year.
No,
and then I have another tip-top secret at the moment, creator-owned project, and I won't even say who it's for or who I'm doing it with, but it will be really, I'm really excited about it, really looking forward to it, but I just can't talk about it yet. And along with that, let's see what else. I've worked on a couple of, you know, Warner Brothers has these direct-to-DVD movies that they do based on the various DC characters, and I just finished the second one last month. So I've done two of those. The first one will be out next spring, and it's another one that I'd love to talk about, but I can't say anything about it. But I just really, really fun projects, and you know, I've done a lot of animation over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so. And these projects were among the most fun I've ever done. So I'm really excited and looking forward to them coming out. At least the first one will be out in the spring. I'm sure the second one won't be out until the end of 2015.
That's really exciting, especially because like the DC animation department, it's just consistently good, you know, good releases for both. I mean, my son is in love with Ben 10 and Teen Titans Go, but there are also things that I really enjoy watching too. And all the DC animated movies, that those directed DVD movies, are always, oh, they're always fun to watch.
They understand those characters, these guys. They really, really respect them. They treat them the right way. And plus, most of those guys working there are writers. They're, you know, they're not like, it's not like some, you know, I'm working on these movies. It's not like some executive giving me notes. It's, you know,
right.
Alan Burnett giving me notes. And they really understand story. I mean, I worked on Justice League Unlimited, and I think, you know, that's as good a version of the Justice League as we've ever seen anywhere, you know, bar none.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you talk about, you know, watching it with kids. I did a whole lot of episodes of Batman Brave and the Bold, and that was a show
Instantly,
people came up to me and said, "I love to sit and watch it with my son or with my daughter, and we both enjoy it." And that's a rare thing, you know.
Yeah, and if you compare that to, which is one of my personal favorites, you know, the Batman animated from the '90s is not necessarily suited to my son's age, who's four, but Brave and the Bold is perfect.
Yeah, Brave. That's what I loved working on that show for that very reason. It was. On one level, it was goofy, it was absurd, it was kind of over the top. And on another level, the stories, you know, never broke those characters in any way. You know what I mean? They were exactly right. And some of those stories, they tended to hand me some of the darker ones. I did the one with the Doom Patrol, which is the adaptation of the story where the Doom Patrol dies in the end.
Uh-huh.
And I always think, how many six-year-olds did I traumatize with that story? And, you know, they gave me the one where Red Tornado created a son, and in the end, essentially, does the android version of euthanasia, you know. They weren't all light and fluffy. They had a couple of heavy-duty episodes along the way, too. But it was a great show. But most of the shows that I've worked on, they've been great people, and it's just been a lot of fun. Teen Titans Go now, obviously, is totally kid-friendly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because I wonder how many hardcore comic book fans don't like it, because it takes so many liberties with those characters, but I think they're doing it, you know, for what it is, they're doing it exactly right. It's really, really funny. It's really smart funny. It's not dumb funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fun show. It took me a while, because a lot of times you start to work on these shows before they come on the air. And when seeing one episode suddenly the light bulb, I'll go, oh, now I understand. I understand what they're looking for. So just reading a bunch of scripts, you don't really get the feeling or you don't hear the characters' voices.
Mm-hmm.
So I struggled a little bit with my first couple of episodes of Teen Titans because I don't think I quite nailed what they were looking for. And then I finally saw it and went, oh, that's what it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I have another one coming up whenever, I'm unsure when the new season is starting soon, I think, if it hasn't already. And I have another one of those coming up as well.
We've had a lot of conversations back and forth and with creators about accessibility of characters for all ages audiences. And I think that the DC's animated examples are exactly the type of accessibility that we'd like to see more of. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear, having worked on them, I'm glad to hear that you agree with that. I know that there are liberties taken with the characters, but at the same time, when you're talking about a different medium that could encourage younger readers or new readers to go back and explore the stories in the comics, you know, that's the luxury that you have with an adaptation or just going from comics to animation. I don't think that the hardcore comic fans without children don't necessarily get to dictate that part of the approach, I guess. I'd like to see other characters from DC and Marvel treated that way, so that, like, my son is almost 9, so that then he has a gateway to the comics in a more appropriate way too.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. It's a difficult thing, and if you want to give a superhero comic to a kid, to an actual kid like 10 or younger, it's a hard call.
It is.
Very hard call.
Right now it is, absolutely.
And I think the landscape has shifted so much that it feels to me, this has nothing to do with the quality of the books. I mean, it just has to do with what the target audience is.
Exactly.
The target audience is just older. Mm-hmm. And they're aiming older, and I think on one level we sort of just have to accept it. And even the movies, you know, I mean, I just saw the new X-Men movie, which I thought was really, really terrific. I thought it was one of the best of the Marvel movies. But, you know, this was not a movie for an 8-year-old.
No, not at all.
No,
you know?
Right.
When I hear about the IDW all-ages stuff, and, like, you've got the sequel to your creator and series coming out, and I know there are a bunch of others that are kind of on the docket for IDW in the next year or so, and that's excellent. And we've talked to other creators about their own creator-owned things that are all ages, and all of that, my kid eats it up. But
looking at
a big 2 book for him is tough right now.
Yeah, yeah. When I did Abadazad, one of the reasons I did it when I first started working on it, my daughter was, she's 19 now, but she was probably 7 or something. And there weren't a lot of comics I could give her.
Right.
I wanted to write something that I could read with her, you know, because the best children's literature, and this has been like, I've been on this crusade since the 80s, you know, the best children's literature is really smart. And a parent and a child sit down together and they read it together and they both enjoy it together on different levels, you know,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, Winnie the Pooh or The Wizard of Oz or Narnia or Harry Potter or whatever it may be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously, even within the children's book world, there's different levels, you know, of material. Some of it is suited to much, much younger children. Some of it is suited to an 8 or a 9-year-old. But that's what years and years ago, I pitched, got to almost everybody in the business. I wanted to do an entire line of kid-friendly comics. Basically, the kids' equivalent of the Vertigo line. Really, really well written, beautifully illustrated. You know, really aiming for a high literary level, but kid-friendly. You know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get anybody interested, and that's why I ended up doing Abadazad. You know, later on, and even the project that Mike Klug and I did for Boom a few years after that, called The Stardust Kid, that was something I originally was working on in the 80s, and I couldn't really get it out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's still a crusade of mine, and I think it's really, really important. And I think, you know, on one level, it's okay that mainstream comics are what they are. That's what the audience is. That's who we're writing for, and that's who is responding. It's certainly teenagers and up to, you know, to, I don't know, there are 50-year-olds out there reading this stuff and enjoying it. And I think it's always been, it's been a hard time in recent years whenever anyone tries to do a mainstream Marvel or DC superhero comic that's aimed for all ages, because it always feels like it's got this big stamp on it saying all ages in a way that is off-putting to the other readers. And I think the best all ages material is embracing everybody. And mm-hmm. you know, with Augusta Wind, I think, you know, anyone who's into a fun, big cosmic fantasy story would be able to pick it up and just enjoy it. And the idea is to play it in just such a way that if you're reading it with your 9-year-old, that's okay, you know? But if you're picking it up and you're a 30-year-old without a kid or a 40-year-old without a kid, you should be able to enjoy that too. And that's the razor's edge that you walk with this material, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think that was, you make a very good point about that crusade and the quality of the material being, you know, I think the all-ages stamp gets put on things because there's this perception that it's pretty cookie cutter and it's not it's going to adhere to a fairly, you know, predictable kind of standard, and
right.
it's not going to, you know, go beyond the bounds of what we expect from that quote unquote all ages. But, you know, that,
right.
I agree. I think that is really what the all ages market needs, is that kind of vertigo, high quality,
mm-hmm.
you know, high concept, something that pushes a child's brain beyond what they're expecting.
That would be incredible.
Yeah.
Yes, let's make that happen.
Well, if anybody out there wants to has a couple million bucks to spare and wants to fund that line, I'm ready to edit it for you.
I understand the hesitation because it's about bottom dollar. It's, you know, who takes this risk.
Look at the book world. You know what's the big booming thing in books, and that's kids' books and kids' fantasy, young adult fantasy. That's the stuff that's driving book sales almost more than anything, you know?
Yeah, and Aaron, how many times have we had this conversation now? And it just, I feel like because so many of us who grew up reading comics in the 80s and 90s now have kids around the age or heading into the age that we were when we started reading, and more of us are just looking at, there are 100 amazing all-ages books out there. But that's not enough. There's always room for more. There's always
and they're also,
more
you know,
more.
They're scattered about. You know, you got to poke around and find them.
Right.
There's one over there, and there's one over there, and there's one over there. That's why, to me, the idea of a whole line of this stuff really done up really well would just
mm-hmm.
be
and
would
especially
be a great
if
thing.
You're trying to appeal to parents who are not necessarily, you know, comics geeks don't know, you know, necessarily like to what to expect from something with IDW stamped on it or, you know, Dark Horse stamped on it, where, you know, where they do if they see a DC logo or a Marvel logo. I mean, that's just the, you know, that's just public awareness in a lot of ways. And to me, it's almost like, I don't, you know, it's like, I always make this analogy of, when you ask people like, are you a Marvel or DC guy? You know, it's because it gets ingrained in your DNA early on. And I wonder
mm-hmm.
what will happen to these generation of kids that don't have things that are accessible to them, that aren't getting that kind of, they're not getting the superhero worlds tattooed into their, you know, into their consciousness.
Well, but
sure,
you know,
they are just for movies.
They are.
So. Yeah.
The thing is now, fortunately and unfortunately, you know, these Marvel movies are the biggest thing out there. I mean, one after another, blockbuster after blockbuster, and overall, you know, an occasional stumble here or there, but overall they're damn good, you know?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
so, and I always say there are people out there now who could be the biggest superhero fans on earth, and because they see the movies, they play the video games, maybe they watch the animated shows, and they will never pick up a comic book in their lifetime, you know,
right,
and that's
right.
the sad part of it, you know?
Yeah.
That's really the sad part of it. But, I go to conventions, and all I hear is, you know, it's bigger than last year. It's bigger than last year. More and more people showing up, you know, and all the costumes and all the stuff. And I think a lot of those people are not comic book fans in the sense that we understand. They're fans
yes.
of fantasy. They're fans of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not comic book readers necessarily.
Well, especially if you look at, I mean, it's true that conventions are bigger and bigger every year, but I think you also see, if you take like a Wizards World as an example, they focus on having celebrity guests there
right.
to draw attention in, and a lot, like every booth will have something Walking Dead related, you know, something that is more that people know from the general media.
Right.
And those are the people that are really filling the halls.
There's probably more Doctor Who's walking around than the mm-hmm.
which isn't bad. It just makes it more. It's not comics.
The landscape has shifted, but I hope that as digital permeates more and more, I think a lot of people who maybe read this stuff when they were younger, then the movies come out and they fall in love with them, you know, all over again through the movies. But maybe never in a million years would they find themselves walking into a comic book shop. They would feel too self-conscious for whatever reason.
Sure.
And if they can just, you know, pick up their iPad and go to Comixology or wherever and just click and download an issue of X-Men or Spider-Man or Batman or Superman or whatever it is, you know,
yeah.
I think it's a much more private and personal experience. They don't have to worry about sitting on the subway reading a comic book or whatever it is, you know. And I think the digital doorway is important.
Well, I agree. And it's also, I do see the 20-something-year-old generation who is reading things digitally. There is, well, geek is cool these days, you know. It depends on how you approach it and how you embrace it, but I think it is acceptable for mainstream people to be reading Spider-Man or Justice League or something right. like that. You know, there is a cool factor to it.
It's never had more pop cultural cachet than it does now.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Between, you know, the movies and you know, what you know, and then, you know, the superhero movies, it's Game of Thrones, it's this, it's that, there's so, Doctor Who, there's so much stuff out there. All that stuff that was once marginal mm-hmm. in our culture is what's driving popular culture.
Yeah.
You know, look at, you know, a show like The Big Bang Theory, the number one comedy on television, it's all about country comic book geeks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then makes it acceptable in another way to people who are not that, but they watch that show and they understand it in a different way, and suddenly even they might look at it differently as a result of that. So it's this weird dichotomy that, on one level, this material has never been more popular, these characters have never been more popular, but I don't see that huge popularity necessarily spilling over into comic book sales.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, so let's take a look at that shift. I guess we'll start from the beginning, because I think that being a writer now, getting into writing comics with the wide awareness of that genre that had been, or those multiple genres that had been marginalized, it's a different process than when you first started. And you've written a lot about your process in comics and scripting for television on your blog. Yeah. I want to make sure everybody knows that you have a site. It's called Creation Point. We'll link to it. You're also featured on panels about how to write comics. You have your own Imagination 101 workshop for writers. So it's clear to me that it's important to you to share your insight and your experience with a new generation of writers. But I'm curious if you had mentors of your own at DC or Marvel or elsewhere in the late 70s and early 80s when you were getting your start, because the acceptance of the medium was at a totally different, and the awareness, like we said, was at a totally different point than when you were first getting started.
Oh yeah. Back then, I remember a phrase, I think it came from Denny O'Neill. I can't swear to it. The comics were the golden ghetto, meaning, you know, you had your idea. Once you were in the door, you could sell your ideas. You could make a living, but you know, you were like hidden in the corner somewhere. No one was paying attention to you. The mainstream world didn't know anything about you or what you were doing. But there was a living to be made, and you got to have fun. And so it was. No one got into comics in those days to make money, to make a big name for themselves. People got into comics, and I think still overall, the truth is anyone's going to get into comics for the most part is getting into it because they love the medium. It's mm-hmm. the only reason to get into it. It's the only reason to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever else comes afterwards. But, you know, I'm a great believer in you have to really love what you do. You have to be passionate about what you do. Or go do something else, you know. Don't waste your time and don't waste your audience's time. So for me, getting into comics was just about, I love comics. I'm a creative person, and I want to mm-hmm. write them. It was not about any bigger dream than that. You know, I never did see myself though just as a comic book writer. I always knew I would go on and write other things and do other things, but I loved comics and I wanted to do it. And in the beginning, I didn't even care if they paid me. I mean, that they did, but whatever the beginning page rate when I started, honest to God, was about, for writers, was $13 a page, which Nothing, but I was, you know, young. I was in my early 20s and 13, you know, I get a check for an 8-page story. Hey, that covered the rent and a slice of pizza. That was good. But you talk about mentors. I guess I worked with a lot of really good people. Paul Levitz bought my very, very first comic book script. I worked with Jack Harris over at DC. But Len Wein was the guy who really stepped forward for me. And not in any way to denigrate what Paul and Jack did for me, but Len was the guy that really kind of went, you know, you're not just another guy walking through the hall here. You have something. You have something unique. You have a talent here, and I want to work with you and develop that. And to have someone of Len's stature, someone that I really looked up to and respected, work with me in that way was a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went over to Marvel, you know, in the beginning I worked a lot with Jim Shooter, who was a very, very smart and knowledgeable guy, and learned a lot about the craft of comics from him as well. But Len, more than anybody, it was the figure in the beginning of my comic book career who really stepped up and made me feel like, hey, maybe I really can do this.
Did that influence you then now as a writer who's been involved as long as you have to make attempts to have those types of mentor-mentee relationships with new writers as well?
You know, it's not that it's such a... at least it didn't start as a big conscious thing. It was just sort of a natural outgrowth. And, you know, over the years, there's always someone says, oh, would you look at my stuff? Would you read this? Would you read that? And then you read it, and you give them some feedback. And as you give them feedback, you realize, oh, I've been doing this long enough that I actually know a lot.
Mm-hmm.
and then you mentioned, you know, you sit on a panel somewhere, and you start to talk about story, and you're like, I love talking about story. This is really, really fun, you know. And that's what led me to put together this Imagination 101 workshop, which unfortunately the past year I've been so busy I haven't had a chance to do one this year. And I was just talking to my wife about it, saying I'd love to do a couple more in the fall, because I have some folks that took the 101 workshop. I want to take the 102, and I'd love to do another 101. But the first time I did it, you know, did the workshop, I didn't know going into it what it was going to be like, who was going to show up, and the people that have showed up for all these workshops have just been wonderful. And to be sitting around a table, you know, for a weekend, the 101 workshop is 3 days, the 102 workshop is 4 days, it's so much fun to talk about story, to work with people that are creative and excited and really, really, really want to learn. It's a wonderful thing. So I get as much out of it as anyone that walks through the door, you know.
That's great.
Yeah, so it's a great thing, and I really, really enjoy it.
I have a kind of a follow-up to that, like that kind of setting, that, you know, that the collaborative, the discussion, you know, getting those creative juices flowing in that respect. It's,
yeah.
It seems like the creative process of comic books has changed now that it's not New York, you know, it's not the bullpen anymore. You know, people are everywhere and they're accessible to each other, but is it the same as having a group of people together, you know, creating story that way? Or is there something lost now in the creative process in the current,
you know,
model?
For me, you know, the bottom line as a freelance writer is 90% of your time is spent alone in a room. And
mm-hmm.
And when I still lived in New York City, I was still spending most of my time alone in a room. You know, it's always fun to go up to the office and sit down with your editor and go out to lunch and walk around and say hello to everybody. But, you know, the vast majority of the work is done by yourself.
Mm.
And you know, then I moved out of the city and so the kind of Marvel bullpen thing was something that was the 60s, you know?
Uh-huh.
So by the time I was in the business, you know, living in New York, it was always great to have access, and it's still fun when I go down and I can go up to the office. It's a nice thing. But really the bulk of the freelance life for all of us is sitting around alone.
Mm.
The thing that I miss most of all, which happened as a result of, you know, the age of email, is that once upon a time you'd be working and, you know, I would say I was working on Spider-Man and Danny Fingeroth, who was my editor, would maybe call me up 3 times a day with a question about this or a thought about that, and then he'd call me the next day and the next day. And all your editors were calling and you were talking to your artists on the phone, and it was, there was a connection that way. And email is great, and, you know, we're all addicted to it and it's wonderful, but I do miss that personal connection. It's a different thing when you pick up the phone and there's a voice on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Versus just an email on the other end. So that's what I miss.
Yeah, and it's not answering the question that's posed to you. It's what comes out of the conversation spurned by that,
yeah,
you know, and how the story changes from it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so that's what I miss. But really, you know, so much of what we do is really, I would say, you know, I get paid to sit alone in a room and play with my imaginary friends, and that's what I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful that people still pay me to do it. It's a nice way to make a living.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, that creative process. You know, you've talked about the importance of music in your life and as a musician before you became a writer. Is the influence of music on your creative approach to storytelling, has that made a big difference, in especially in comics? Or do you listen to music while you brainstorm a script or dialogue, or do you use music to communicate?
You know, it's interesting because it took me years to figure this out. And one day I had this like epiphany, like, oh, whatever I do creatively, I'm still doing it as a musician. And it was like a really deep insight. Then I had to figure out what the hell that meant. Just let me jump to one other thing. I said, for the most part, I can listen to music sometimes when I'm working. There's a certain point where I engage the story. And even then, if I have music on, 99% of the time, it has to be instrumental music. Mm. You know, whether it's some weird ambient music or some floaty new age music or a movie score or something. The minute singing and lyrics and all that come in, it starts to like hurt my brain. And then there's a certain point in the process of engagement where I just have to like shut everything off and it's just begin the story. Mm. And I can't hear it. I can't be distracted. But I realize that, yeah, you know, there's a certain flow. And I'm a songwriter as well, and I sing, and there's a certain flow to music, to singing, to creating a song. And there's a certain rhythm and a beat, and that's one of the things I talk about in this workshop. But, you know, you look at a comic book page, and it's sort of like poetry, and it's sort of like a song lyric, and it has music underneath, because the way, when things are broken down into captions, say, you have captions, dialogue, and they're interacting, and they're moving across the page in a certain way, there's a rhythm to it, and there's a beat, and there's a flow that's very, very musical. Mm-hmm. And then the hook at the end that gets you to turn the page and carries that lyric over to the next part of the song or the next page in the comic. There's a lot of that I mm-hmm. find in comic books. You know, a lot of people like to write about comics being movies on paper, and they have certainly that if you want them to be. My feeling is comics can be anything we want them to be, but I think there's a great link with music and with poetry, because the way of working, writing things in these little boxes, you know, there's a box, and each little box has to have its own rhythm and its own flavor and its own beginning, middle, and end of what you're saying just in that caption, which then leads into the next caption, or the rhythm when it goes from caption to dialogue and back to caption again. There's a real, real rhythm and a drum beat that I certainly feel and hear in my head when I'm writing this stuff, and that's really, really important. Or the way, you know, there's the flow of the dialogue and the captions, and suddenly there's a pause because you have 4 panels where there's nothing in it, and you take that breath, and then the song comes back again, the song being the continuation of the story. So there is a lot of musicality, at least the way I see it, in writing for comics, and in writing in general, but comics, because it's broken up that way, in these little bites, you know, each page is consists of all these different little bites of information, you know, it's very musical and very poetic.
That's great. I love the way that you describe that. I teach playwriting, and sometimes we do short dialogue exercises with music as the influencer for the tone of the dialogue. And there is always a direct correlation between the feel of the music and the rhythm of that short scene or that very short dialogue exchange that my students have created. And we talk about it. We talk about how that rhythm is the same language, whether it's in music or whether it's on the page. And it's great to hear you describe it that way also.
Yeah, very much so. And then, you know, these a lot of these stories and characters are, they exist in this realm that is not reality really as we perceive it. You know, it's like it's a world unto itself. I would say a book like Phantom Stranger, which I work on now, which I really love. It's mystical, it's magical, it's dealing with the philosophical and metaphysical themes that lend itself to a very sort of heightened poetic lyrical style, you know?
Yeah.
I aim for emotional realism, certainly, because you always want the emotions to be true. It doesn't matter if you're writing, whether it's Lord of the Rings or Brooklyn Dreams. You know, you want the emotional truth to be at the core of it. But it's lyrical, and it's got this wonderful sort of floating quality to it, you know, that I really, really enjoy. And it's very, very musical and very poetic. And that's why I've really enjoyed the past year or two. I've been working a lot of this between Justice League Dark and Phantom Stranger. This is a whole supernatural corner of the DC universe, which really opens itself up to that sort of philosophical exploration and metaphysical exploration and a sort of soul poetry that really, for me, fits like a glove. And I really, really have enjoyed working on those books for that reason.
I guess on that note, are you willing to talk a little bit about your spiritual beliefs and how they've intersected with your storytelling? I'm thinking specifically of Dr. Fate, but it's obviously present in other books. Is that something that you had to be upfront about with DC editorial?
You know, it's not like I'm trying to write a spiritual or religious tract. Do you know what I mean?
Right, no, obviously.
So we shouldn't be leaving copies of Justice League Dark on people's windshields or anything like that?
That would be a big mistake.
I mean, that would actually be kind of awesome.
Sure.
But.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just that these are just because of, you know, since I was a teenager, the things that really obsessed me were the big questions, the whys and the wherefores, both psychologically and spiritually, of our existence. You know, and that sounds really big, but I think when you strip it away for everybody, if we look inside our souls, we're all asking those questions. You know, why am I here? What is this about? What is reality? And, you know, the more you push into that, the more you see that reality is many, many things, which is, again, another great thing about these magical books, because you can really literalize that in a story and play with it and explore it. Or you mentioned Will World before, which is all about peeling back layers of the dream, layer after layer after layer.
Right.
So it's not so much about trying to say, and this is my, you know, this is my spiritual belief, and I'm putting it in the story, as much as, you know, these kinds of stories are wonderful vehicles to explore those big primal spiritual questions.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I've woven things more specifically in there. Meher Baba has certainly woven through a number of my stories, and you know, as well it should be, because that's sort of the spiritual core and center of my life and has informed my perception of everything for many, many years. But it's not like I'm not writing a story to try to convince someone to be a follower of Meher Baba. It's just that's one of the filters that these things come through.
Sure. I mean, everyone writes to their inspirations and the deep, you know, the important things in their life.
Everyone has their themes. Everyone has their obsessions, you know, and mine really are about, in my workshop, I call it the big why, you know, whether when you're exploring a character, when you want to make that character fresh, when you want to make that character real, you got to ask the big why. Why is this, you go back to Craven's last time, why is this guy running around in leopard skin pedal pushers trying to kill Spider-Man?
Right.
What the hell happened to him when he was a kid? You know what I mean? And whether it's the big why of our psychological existence or the big why of our existence in the universe, you know, to me, those are the things that I find fascinating. And if you just sort of drift off into the philosophical end of it, I think you sort of end up, if I may say, up your own ass, which is not necessarily a good thing for a story. It has to be grounded in characters that the readers care about. It has to be grounded in real emotional truth to go with the psychological truth and the spiritual truth, you know? So people have something to hang on and someone to relate to and someone to care about. Because, you know, you can find these themes even in my Spider-Man stories, in my mainstream superhero work, you know? I've woven these things into some of the fun, goofy stuff that Giffen and I do together, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's also very obviously in... My son read Imagine Alice last year, and he loved it. And we had some we had some great conversations about what is real and perception and what makes things real and the nature of dreams and, like, really big ideas for an 8-year-old to contemplate.
Oh, and that's great. That makes me really happy to hear that.
Good. I mean, we have great conversations when he really gets into stories, but it's one of those things that we kept coming back to because, you know, it was probably his first exposure to characters, like you said, characters that he could relate to and that he was really interested in reading their stories, but then thinking bigger, thinking about whys and thinking at a more metaphysical level about kind of the nature of their relationships and their experiences.
That's
so great. I know that you read a lot of comics as a kid. did you read fantasy novels like that also? Did you have exposure to that as a reader?
Yeah, I was always attracted to fantasy, whether it was being 6 years old and seeing the Twilight Zone for the first time and having my mind blown, or reading about King Arthur, or reading comics, whatever it was. Because to bring it back to what you're saying, to me, I'll use the Twilight Zone as a perfect example. To me, I look back and I think, was that show, did it impress me so much? Was it forming my view of reality, or did I respond to it because somewhere in my soul, I knew that this was the most accurate view of reality that I was seeing on television as a kid, you know? I think it's the latter. I think, fantasy is such a great doorway to explore so-called reality, because to me, the more I see of it, the more fantastic the so-called real world is, the more, you push beneath what I call the skin of the world, and it's just, you can reach in and pull out handfuls of miracles. It's an amazing, fantastic, mind-blowing universe, and fantasy is a wonderful vehicle because, to me, it captures reality better than so-called realistic fiction does.
Mm-hmm.
There's really two kinds of fiction that I really enjoy. One is, fantasy fiction that helps us to see reality in a different way, and then there are novels that are, quote, realistic, but push so deep in their realism that they sort of pop out the other end. Well, I love Ray Bradbury, but my favorite Ray Bradbury book is Dandelion Wine, which is not a fantasy in its traditional sense, but it's a summer in a boy's life looking out with eyes of wonder and miracles at the world around him, And so that the real world becomes a world of fantasy. And part of that is what I tried to get at in Brooklyn Dreams as well. Was that Brooklyn Dreams and Moonshadow, I always looked at as mirror images of each other. One was my life growing up turned into fantasy, and the other was a more accurate so-called realistic depiction of it, but both ended up sort of in the same magical, fantastical place because reality and fantasy meet in the same place in the middle, So whether you're talking about Bradbury so the writers that I love, whether they're fantasy writers or so-called realistic writers, are the ones that really dig their fingers in the earth and, see that there's miracles just below the surface. Yeah.
Well, and then you're asking the same questions in response to both types of books. Like, they're prompting the same examination and navel gazing and contemplation. And that's the part that I enjoy as a reader. And then that's obviously the part that I really, really love seeing my son get exposed to and then kind of sharing it with him also.
Right. Well, it's sort of what I was saying about, for me, being 6 years old and watching Twilight Zone and the scales falling from my eyes, And I'm sure when your son read Imaginalis, he was responding to it because some part of him already knew that, already felt that, already believed that, and the book was a mirror for him in some way,
Yeah, it's cool.
I think all those truths are inside us, and we just sometimes we need someone to come knock on the door and go, hey, look at what you already know,
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess, in a way, we like to say, like, we take things for granted as we get older, but I think it's just we forget about the magic of the world as we get older. We become more, immune to it in a way, inured to it or something. And children still have a very thin layer between that sort of, the veneer of reality hasn't thickened yet.
Right, exactly. And one of the great things about doing what I do for a living is, you have to constantly remain in touch with that kid with those eyes of wonder. You have to, in order to do the work. Even if it's a fantasy being written for adults, it requires those eyes of innocence, and it requires eyes capable of seeing miracles. It requires a child, in the best sense of that word, to do it. And it also keeps that child alive in you while you're doing it. And then, as you said, just having kids does that tremendously.
Let me ask you, in terms of writing, and say, take something like Justice League 3000, which is taking, these popular heroes that people are familiar with, and there's a comfort in that, but you're still trying to write something new and wonderful and, fantastical, but is it harder when it's something you're so familiar with? I'm thinking of writing something that you've written, some, you know, characters you've written for so long being sort of the reality we're used to in a way. And so how do you keep getting that freshness of the new and, you know, the possibility?
Well, if you talk about Justice League 3000, I think as it's been evolving, I think it's been, in the beginning, it was harder for the readers than it was for us. You know?
Yeah, right.
Because they're going in with a certain set of expectations. For me, once I started working on this, and that's the beauty of this when it works right, it's like you just walk into the characters, and suddenly I'm not thinking about Superman as we know him. I'm mm-hmm. thinking about this particular Superman that we're writing in this story, who is very different than the Superman we know, and the same for Batman and Wonder Woman and all the rest of them.
But there still has to be a subtlety to the change. You can't, you know, you are writing a different version of them, but you still have to adhere to, even if it's the opposites of the reality people expect.
Right, right. But, you know, the when a story is working, I'm not thinking about any of that stuff.
Hmm.
When a story is really working, I'm not consciously there at all. You know, when it's really, really working, it's like if someone has ripped open a door at the back of my head and they're stuffing story through from this magical dimension of story somewhere, and I just happen to be the vehicle to get it on the page, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I, you know, and again, something, there's a whole other level here, because when I work with Keith, it's not just me, it's a sort of mind meld of two people.
Yeah.
And Keith is crafting the plots for the most part, and for the most part, I'm crafting, you know, the dialogue and the captions and hopefully deepening the characters and building things on top of these brilliant plots that Keith creates, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So then it becomes something that's also very much beyond me, but in a different way, because Keith and I merge into this other entity, this other writing entity, and that's always been a really magical collaboration, but in a very different way, So, you know, the things that I write with Keith are not necessarily things that I would ever write by myself.
Mm.
But that's the fun of it, too, the fun of what we just finished up on Larfleas. And the fun of doing a book like Larfleas is it's like, oh, my God, I have some place to go every month where I can be a total idiot. And Keith and I give each other permission to be total idiots. And it's great. You know, it's really great.
Does that help in that creative process, like where you have someone reaffirming that you can do whatever you want, as opposed to having to check with yourself? Is it sometimes nice to have that external validation, the external permission?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think was it Keith that said this, or I did? I think it was Keith that you know, we're left to our own devices. We're really different, and Keith would, like, you know, would go just, you know, set himself on fire and jump off the edge of the world, kind of thing, you know. And my job is sort of I run after him, I grab hold of his legs and try to slow him down a little bit, and he's just dragging me farther than I would go when I pulled him back from the abyss.
Mm.
And somehow in that push and pull, we've created something that neither one of us could create alone, you know, and that's really the fun of it.
Hmm. I have one last question, and it's been hard for me to try to formulate and how to articulate it properly, so hopefully this makes sense, but I've been thinking a lot about the, like, big two storylines, and now, you know, we're, whatever, 70 years of superhero stories. Where is the balance, and what's the importance of retelling stories of old and for new audiences and adding new, and where do the new stories come from? You know, if that makes sense. Like, there is a rehashing in a way.
You mean specifically with these characters that have been around for all these years?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if we take DC as an example, especially the last couple of years, you have a reboot of the DC universe. And with that, I see these opportunities to retell story, you know, classic storylines now with a fresh, you know, reboot on them. But I think there's an advantage and a disadvantage of that, because you also, in theory, have new audiences that aren't familiar with the old stories, and the old stories might not read, you know, correctly to a new audience too. But at the same time, you want to add new layers to these already, you know, massive universes with so much story already in them. You know, where's the critical mass, and do we end up then just retelling the same stories over and over?
Yeah, on one level, I think we do. And what happens is, with each generation, the language for that story shifts a little bit. You know,
mm-hmm.
the language of comic book writing now is not the same as it was in 1985, and that wasn't the same as it was in 1966, and that wasn't the same as it was in 1945, you know?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet you could probably strip away a lot of these stories and find the same story underneath. you know?
Yeah.
And what may change is the way the story is expressed, the way we sort of maybe crack into the characters' heads. But I think there are, these are, to use an overused word, these are iconic characters, at least the big ones are, and they have iconic moments that sort of reassert themselves no matter what. But everyone sort of jumps in. I've actually been thinking about writing a blog post about this because I have this image of this giant whale moving through the ocean. It's this like giant story whale, and we all jump on, you know. And I'm actually going to be using something around like this in the next Augusta Wind series. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's almost like, you know, this whale has been swimming forever, and it's going to be swimming forever. And each of us kind of comes up in our boat, and we jump on the whale. And we, you know, if you want to use a sort of whaling thing, we're sticking in a harpoon or we're painting on it,
yeah,
however you want to do it, you know. But we're all adding to this massive story that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and yet the story has been there forever and will be there forever. And what we have to do is find something fresh and new in it, without, at least with these characters, without violating the fundamentals of what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it kind of goes back to what we're saying with the big why. You have to ask some fundamental psychological questions. And it's always interesting and amazing to me that there are still lots of questions about these characters and their inner workings that haven't been asked, you know?
Mm.
And that will make it fresh. And yeah, they're the primal moments that will always get repeated. It doesn't matter, you know, how many times has the DC Universe been rebooted, and Marvel, maybe they don't reboot it in the same way, but they find their sneaky ways to completely reboot it, and it really is the same thing in the end, you know?
Yeah.
And because you're always looking for ways to clear the decks and slough off the continuity, and yet it always comes back in, you know? Remember when they rebooted Superman in the 80s, and it was all fresh and new,
mm-hmm,
but then, as it should have been, you know, oh, look, Bizarro's back,
mm-hmm,
and this is back, and this is happening again, and look at that, and so it's a slightly different flavor, and you get to bring those characters in again. But eventually they all sort of begin to reassert themselves because, and this is another one of my things that I return to again and again, the stories have lives of their own, and I really believe that.
Mm.
And we are the vessels and we are the vehicles, or we're the guys painting on the side of the whale as it's swimming by, but the story keeps swimming, you know?
It's almost as if, like, as the creator, you have no free will. You're there to push the story into the world. It's going to be there one way or the other.
Yeah, I there has been some magical times in my career where it really, you know, wasn't just an intellectual idea. It really, really, really worked like that, where things appear in your story that you never thought of, that you never planned, and suddenly the story goes galloping off in some new direction. And you know you had absolutely nothing to do with it. You know? I see us as individual creators, it's sort of like in stage lighting. You know, there's a different colored filter you can put over the lights. It's the same light, but you put that blue filter and it creates one mood. You put the red filter, it creates another mood. You mix a couple of filters together, it creates something else. But behind it is the same light. And I always have this feeling that there's, you know, the stories are sort of swooping around, they're looking for the right vehicle. Oh, is it him this time? No, is it him? Oh, yeah. All right, I like his filter. But it's the same. It's just the same light coming through. We as creators have a specific filter, which is the filter of our experience and our obsessions and the experiences that formed us as children. And so we will take that idea and express it slightly differently. But that story came from someplace else.
Hmm.
And I see it also over the years when I've worked on these sort of big crossovers, where you sit in a room with three or four or five other people and you're putting story together. And you're all sort of merging your consciousness and creating what the big arc is going to be for the next 6 months. And yet, everyone goes home, and because of those individual filters, what comes out on the page is so different. I'd always be astounded. Like, you know, I went home understanding the story one way and wrote my version of it. And then you read the other guy's issue, and it was something really, really different because it's coming out of their filter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we all sort of agreed on it in the room, it all mutates and becomes something else. So it's this sort of push-pull between this sort of magical, self-replicating story and our personal stamp that we put on it. And, you know, to get back to the big and the metaphysical, and really why I love stories so much is I really think that that's what we are living in right now. This is God's dream. This is one big, massive, interactive story that we're living in. And when I sit down as a writer, it's almost like replicating that act of creation that that came out of the divine when he created this dream universe that we're all swimming around in. And then we're creating sub-universes within that universe. And who knows what the characters in those stories are writing and creating within their story, you know? So that's why I love writing stories about story, because really writing stories about story, and that's what a lot of Augusta Wind is about, is really writing stories about what our lives are about and what the nature of reality is about, and why are we here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway.
That's great.
That covered a lot of ground, didn't it?
No,
that's hoping to do.
Yeah, that really, I love that perspective, too, because it's easy to dismiss things as, you know, the metaphysical and spiritual. It's easy to dismiss them, you know, by claiming, well, it's not, it has nothing to do with reality. When you look at it and break it down that way, it has everything to do with reality.
Yeah, it is reality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jam, for joining us this week.
Well, thanks for a lot of interesting questions. Yeah, that this is not, we didn't run down the typical path here, which I really appreciated.
we try not to.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just throw out my plugs and remind everybody, please, if you can, read Phantom Stranger and Justice League Dark and what else am I writing? Oh, Justice League 3000 and look for my new projects. And if you want to visit me at my website, jamdmateus.com, please do. I really like interacting with people on Twitter and at my website. So if you're going to write and leave a comment on my website, I'm going to answer you. And if you want to talk to me on Twitter, I'm going to talk to you. Because, like I said, I spend most of my time alone in a room with my imaginary friends. So it's nice connecting with the people that are reading and appreciating the work.
Yearning for any kind of contact, no matter where it comes from.
Please talk to me.
Well, just as a reminder to everyone else, you know, don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop or subscribe to them digitally. You can always find our show notes and other details on our website on comicstherapy.com. And we'll talk to everyone next week.
Understand me like I understand you. Now, girl, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to break up our happy home. Oh, I don't get so excited. Children, when we argue, fuss and fight.